You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Aaron Clausett, an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Colorado at Boulder and in the BioFrontiers Institute and external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks, Dave.
Aaron, I saw an article online actually last September, and that was when we first communicated with each other. I communicated with you to do an interview. It was titled, Statisticians Calculate Probability of Another 9/11 Attack. And according to the statistics, there is a 50% chance of another catastrophic terrorist attack within the next 10 years. And of course, the actual name of your study was Estimating the Historical and Future Probabilities of Large Terrorist Events. Now, I want to get into that in great detail in a moment. Before we do, for the benefit of listeners, can you just give them a little bit of background about who you are, what you do, and what exactly is the BioFrontiers Institute, because that sounds cool, and the Santa Fe Institute?
Absolutely. So I'm an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Colorado Boulder. So this is a Research One university. It's the flagship university in Colorado. And I've been there for 3 years as a professor. And my job is affiliated with this thing, as you said, the BioFrontiers Institute. This is a new organization inside the university, and it's intended to bring biologists and computer scientists and mathematicians together to work on problems of interest to society and also, of course, to science. And so some of my work is actually in essentially biomedical or mathematical models of biomedical systems. But I also do work on the side on other systems, and the terrorism study that you found is one of those areas I also work in. I've worked in that area for almost 10 years now, and I do sort of one paper a year looking at a couple of interesting patterns in the global statistics of terrorism, and the study you found reference to is the most recent study that I completed. I am also affiliated with this thing, as you said, the Santa Fe Institute. That's located in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and this is an interdisciplinary private research organization with about 10 resident faculty and maybe a dozen postdoctoral research fellows. And this is a unique place. It's highly interdisciplinary, meaning that there are natural scientists, social scientists, and biological scientists who all work there and visit there, and they work on theoretical problems of interest to society, mostly related to what we call complex systems. So these are not the traditional kinds of things that you might find studied in an engineering department or in a physics department, but more like sort of computational biology or computational social science, where we're trying to find sort of the fundamental mathematical laws that tell us how these complicated systems work.
That's very cool. And for the BioFrontiers Institute, are there major donors or funders of that institute?
Yes, there are a number of major donors and funders for the BioFrontiers. Because it's part of the University of Colorado, those donations, of course, all are essentially to the university. The state of Colorado is a major beneficiary to the institute. They gave a lot of money to help us build a new building, and we've had a number of major corporations give money to help build the facility. And this is largely because the biotechnology is an exciting new area. There's clearly commercial applications for this, and the university is aware of that. So the idea is to try to create synergy between academic researchers and industry and Colorado in order to push forward biomedical research in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always good to know who's behind the funding. Would you happen to know any of the names of these major corporations?
I'm not usually involved with the fundraising. I believe there have been a number of press releases to sort of document it. Chevron, I think, gave a bunch of money for a biofuels facility inside the institute, and I think Oracle has given us some money for some of the computational stuff. But these are, you know, major multinational corporations. The usual situation with funding with universities is that when a corporation wants to make a donation, they're only allowed to simply make a donation. So there's almost no quid pro quo in response. So they're funding basic research, and that is the mission for the university and for the institute. They're not funding specific research on specific questions. Any patents that are developed would, of course, be held by the university, not by the corporation. So it's a little bit different from the standard kind of sponsored research kind of situation. The vast majority of the money for the BioFrontiers Institute and also for the university, of course, for research comes from the federal government along with private foundations. So the National Science Foundation is essentially the major funder of some of the work, and the other major funder is the National Institutes of Health, which I think those two together account for 80 or 90% of the money that actually funds the research. The corporate donations are typically given to build facilities. So there's a state-of-the-art sequencing facility in the BioFrontiers Institute that many of the biologists use. I'm a computational person, so I use computers to do my research. And all of my hardware, of course, has been purchased using either money from my grant from the federal government or from money from the University of Colorado.
Thank you for explaining that. Yeah, I was just about to ask, what about Uncle Sam? But you answered it. Thanks so much. Now, let's get into this study here. First, I want, if you could, for the benefit of the listeners, in the introduction, I said that came out in September, at least to the press in the beginning of September, and we had communicated since then. Could you explain to the listeners why it took so long to discuss this publicly?
So in academia, the way science moves forward is by this process called peer review. So when a scientist like myself finishes a study, we write up a report about it, a paper, and we often will post it in what's called a preprint server. And in this case, I posted an early version of the paper on this thing called the archive, which is a place where many physicists and computer scientists post early versions of their papers, largely so that other scientists can see them and give us feedback. Now, of course, this is a public server, and journalists often are looking for interesting stories to discuss. And sometimes people will get contacted after they post their papers on this. But the primary purpose of the archive is to create a permanent open access version of the paper, but also for the scientific community to get an early look at the study. Now, the next step of the process is peer review, in which the article is submitted to a journal. In this case, it was called the Annals of Applied Statistics. And that journal then conducts the peer review process, in which the article is sent to several experts in the field, and they get a critical look at it, and they then write reports about whether they think it's right or wrong and what could be improved. That process is slow, largely because the scientists, they're all volunteering their time, and it takes several months for one round of these reports to be written, and then the authors, myself in this case, get a few months to respond to that, revise the manuscript, then send it back, and then there's a few more months for the referees to write new reports, and then finally an editor makes a decision about whether the paper has passed the peer review process. Essentially, they take into account the recommendations of the referees. So this peer review process is how all of science works. And any article that is published in a journal has gone through this peer review process. Now, the Annals of Applied Statistics, where this article will appear later this year, is a fairly strongly respected journal, and they do a fairly rigorous process with their peer review. So I think overall it took roughly about 9 or 10 months for the entire process to be completed. And then, of course, once the paper is accepted, then it takes another 9 or 10 months for it to appear. And this is slow mainly because it's all volunteer work on the referees and the scientist side. And this is essentially at the heart of what's called the open access movement now in academia, which is to make all research that's been done by scientists, but especially the research sponsored by the federal government, freely available to the public, since the public has essentially paid for it through the tax dollars that the federal government gives us in the form of grants. So there's a huge movement in terms of open access, and that's one of the reasons why I posted a preprint version of it on this open access server, the archive.
Great. Thank you for explaining that. Did any other journalists pester you like I did?
I did receive a few other queries for interviews because this is a very topical subject, the idea that there might be an ability to make a weather forecast, if you will, of sort of what the probability of a large terrorist attack like 9/11 might be in the next 10 years. And I told them the same thing I told you, which is that I generally try not to talk to journalists about work that hasn't passed peer review yet. It's considered essentially bad form in academia to do so, and there have been a number of instances in the past in which scientists have gotten themselves into big trouble, mainly with other scientists, for bypassing the peer review process and discussing their work in the press before it's passed that critical examination.
Sure, of course, but did they follow up with you, or was I the only one to follow up on a regular basis with you?
You were the most persistent, that's for sure, and I certainly appreciate that. And I think that when the article appears later this year, there might be additional queries. But as you know, with journalism, you have to strike when the iron is hot, when a paper just appears. Otherwise, there's a bunch of stories that come out, and yours doesn't get as much attention.
All right, so this is the first interview you're giving on the study.
That is correct. This is the first interview I'm giving on this study.
What motivated the study?
As I said, I've been working in this area, thinking about the global patterns and the statistics of terrorist events for about 10 years now, and this was sort of the next idea to work on. Early on in that process, I got interested in the idea that not the motivation or the decision behind making a terrorist attack, I'm not interested in that subject at all, but rather the size of the event. This is something that we can measure. There's lots of data on it, and I became interested in trying to understand whether there were patterns at the global level in the size of the terrorist event. And in a 2007 study that I published in the Journal of Conflict Resolution, I identified that there is, in fact, a very unusual pattern with respect to the frequency of these large events. So this pattern is what, in the business, we call a power law distribution. The easiest way to understand what that means is the statistics, the frequency and the size of these terrorist events follows a pattern very much like what earthquakes follow. So So we all have probably heard of this thing called the Gutenberg-Richter scale. And in fact, when large earthquakes happen, they talk about the magnitude. So a magnitude 8 earthquake is the size of the earthquake. But it's meant to denote the fact that a magnitude 8 earthquake is more rare than a magnitude 7, which is less big. But it's more rare in a very mathematical way. Essentially, a magnitude 8 earthquake happens roughly 10 times less often than a magnitude 7 earthquake. So that same pattern of the relative frequency of large events happens to also appear with the size of the terrorist attacks. And so that was the first pattern that I identified in 2007. And the most recent study was saying, well, we can fit some mathematical models to these patterns and then use those models to make forecasts in much the same way people can make forecasts for earthquakes, to say things like, we expect on average to see an earthquake about the size of a magnitude 8 earthquake in the Bay Area in the U.S. about once every 100 years. We can make the similar kinds of mathematically driven statements about terrorist events. And this paper essentially laid out the statistical methodology by which you could do that.
So what are some of the main points that were uncovered from the study?
The first question the study focused on was whether or not an event the size of 9/11, which killed approximately 2,700 people in the official records, although some estimates are slightly more, slightly less, but they're all roughly in that range. The question was whether or not an event the size of 9/11 was sort of unlikely statistically, given the entire global history of all terrorist events and their sizes over the past 40 years. So this is asking whether or not 9/11 was different, whether it's an outlier relative to sort of what normally goes on in terrorism worldwide. So this was a question that we could answer mathematically. We could test strongly whether or not 9/11 was unexpected relative to sort of the background distribution of event sizes and how often they occur. The first finding we did when we constructed this methodology was to discover that no, in fact, 9/11 was not unexpected at all, in the sense that we can put a probability estimate, a bit like weather forecasting, say there's a 30% chance of there being an event as large or larger than 9/11 over that 40-year period of time. So that was the first discovery that we made in the paper.
And some other interesting discoveries.
So there's some debate about exactly what the mathematical form is for the relative frequency of large terrorist events. And so we decided to cover our bases, essentially, and try several of these different mathematical models. The first thing we did was test, are they all plausible? And the answer came back, yes, each of these different mathematical models is reasonable. And then we said, well, what kinds of predictions do each of these models make about the frequency of these large events? Now, the models essentially make different estimates about how large an event you would expect to see in 40 years. But what was surprising was that they all essentially agreed that 9/11 was not statistically unexpected, which is a nice result. It essentially says that even if you don't think that the Fokker or sort of the Gutenberg-Richter type law for terrorism is really the right one, if you think there's some other type of mathematical relationship, it still says that 9/11 would not have been an outlier, that the probability of 9/11 occurring over the past 40 years was not zero, essentially. So that was a second result that came out. And then finally, we wanted to ask the question about, well, if we started looking into the future, we have these models for the past, and we can ask the question now, well, if we make an estimate about how many events we think we might see in the next 10 years, what would be the frequency or probability of another 9/11 size event? So there are lots of assumptions that go into this kind of forecast. It's just like a weather forecast where you have to assume lots of things about the way the clouds move and the way the rain works and so on. But the basic idea is that if the assumptions are correct, then we can make a reasonable mathematically based prediction about what the future might be like. So we did that. And that was where this number of 50% came from. That number that the articles reported in popular press was cherry-picked out of a table of a bunch of different estimates. So we considered three different scenarios, sort of an optimistic scenario in which the frequency of terrorist attacks in general goes down in the next 10 years, a status quo where it remains approximately where it is now, and then sort of a pessimistic possibility where, in fact, the frequency of terrorist attacks worldwide sort of goes up. So this is a simple way of sort of covering the basis of thinking, well, we don't know what the future is going to be like. If terrorism is going to become more popular, stay about the same, or become less popular over the next 10 years. And so we can now ask, given these three different scenarios, what do our different models predict? And only one of the models predicted a 46% chance was the actual number. Most of the models agreed that it was somewhere between sort of 20 and 40, so approximately the same risk globally as we've seen over the past 40 years is the risk for a large event over the next 10 years.
Have you been approached by the intelligence community yet, and do you expect that that might happen?
I've been working in this area for about 10 years, and I've had a number of interactions with people in the Department of Defense, various parts of the Department of Defense, and in the intelligence community. But at no point have they actually expressed any genuine interest in using the techniques that I developed for their kinds of efforts. And I think that the reason is essentially that when I say that the frequency of large terrorist events followed a pattern much like earthquakes, and I make some sort of forecast with the statistical methodology over the next 10 years, it's not clear, I think, to many people in the government how they would then operationalize analyze that piece of information? How will that change their planning or their tactics or their strategies in terms of trying to accomplish the things that are their goals right now? And so in general, the response I get from these communities is, that's really interesting. I'm not quite sure how it's going to help me do my job. And then they move on and I don't hear from them again. So there's been a number of sort of inquiries, sort of seeking more information, but very little follow-up after that.
When you guys did the study, did you take into account, of course, there's a lot of theories about 9/11, probably more theories about 9/11 than just about any other event that's occurred in modern times. Did you take into account that 9/11 may have not occurred according to the government's official theory? And of course, you can call it a conspiracy theory because they are saying that somebody conspired to do this. Did you take into account any other ways that 9/11 might have occurred?
The data that we use is from a large database of terrorist attacks worldwide, and there are about 40,000 events in this database. But the record for an event only stores a few pieces of information. It stores things like the number of deaths, the number of injuries, the date it occurred, the culprit if it's known, although oftentimes it's not known, and then some other information. There's a little text summary at the bottom of the record that gives you some information. All this is culled essentially from news reports. So these were the data that we pass into the algorithm in order to make the forecast and also to make the backcast, the historical estimate too. So only that information was taken into account in order to make our estimate. We only looked at the relative frequency of events based on their sizes. So any sort of conspiracy theories or ideas about the motivation or who did it or why it was done, all that information was on purpose excluded from the model.
I assume that, but I just wanted to ask just to make sure.
I think that in general, it's very difficult to understand how to model from a scientific perspective these kinds of ideas. And one could, in principle, build a mathematical model that tried to incorporate various pieces of information in the news and the conspiracy theory circles and so on. But it would be very difficult to test these ideas because in science, our goal is to falsify the wrong ideas. And the whole point about conspiracy theories is that there's not enough evidence oftentimes to really definitively say, okay, this did not happen this way. So from the scientific perspective, those kinds of theories are essentially irrelevant to science.
Of course, the study didn't just look at 9/11 type dramatic events, but also looked at knives and firearms, right? And fire and other things like that.
That's right. So the database that we use for information about terrorist events includes information about the type of attack, so what weapon was used to produce it, what was the target, and so on. It excludes information about the motivation, the psychological decision about making that attack was, but sort of the measurable things like, you know, what weapon was used, that sort of thing, that was included in the database. And of course, we can then ask questions about the relative frequency of events of different types. And one of the things the database includes, of course, is information about chemical and biological events, which are of great interest to many people. But there's very few events, actually, in the past 40 years that have been classified as chemical or biological attacks. So it's possible to use our statistical framework in order to make a forecast about how large an event do we expect, or rather, what the frequency is of an event of a certain type, like 9/11, if it were to have been a chemical or biological attack. And what we find is essentially there's so little data, it's very difficult to make a principled forecast about how often we expect to see those kinds of attacks. For other types of weapons, of course, there's much more data. Explosives end up being a very large fraction of all the events. More than 50% of terrorist events in the database use some kind of explosives. And when we look at these different types of weapons, chemical, biological, explosives, fire, so arson, firearms, knives is even a category in the database, and then there's this sort of catch-all for other and unknown, what we find is that each of these different weapon types follows essentially the same Gutenberg-Richter type pattern that we see for events in general. And if we ask specific questions about the relative frequency of these events, we can make a sort of a composite estimate. So take into account the information about those weapon types and how severe those events become, we can make a more principled estimate for the frequency of a 9/11-sized event, sort of controlling for the different weapon types. And the overall probability there ends up being actually, in fact, very close, the historical probability, very close to what we got in general. I believe the estimate was somewhere around 50% as opposed to 30% estimate before. And this is mainly because, of course, the explosives attacks are very common and they often kill a lot of people. So if you give the algorithm a little more information, it can make a more precise estimate about what's going on. Now, there's an interesting problem here, which is you can't give the algorithm too much information because there's not enough data to build a proper model on that. And the more detailed the events become, the harder it is to make a general prediction about the future. It would be as if you were trying to make some prediction about in 10 years, how much rain is going to fall on the 13th of January in a particular locale. You don't really have a good idea of what's going to happen there because it's too specific a question. But you can ask the question of how much rainfall do we expect to see over the entire year in one area, or how much rainfall do we expect to see in one day averaged over the entire country. So these kinds of answers, the kinds of answers that the algorithms I developed produce, they're very high-level and very general kinds of statements. So they're not going to help people make specific decisions about specific locations or specific terrorist groups. Instead, they give you a notion of sort of where the action is moving to over time. And in this case, it gives you a very principled, sort of data-driven estimate of the global probability of a large terrorist event. And then it's up to the intelligence people or the military people to figure out who's likely to do it and where it's likely to go and so on. And in fact, it's not hard to think of where it might likely happen. It's essentially the hot spots in the world and the big targets in the world. But that's not something that I have done any work on. Most of what I'm trying to do is just try to develop this idea that we can think about the general patterns in terrorism worldwide.
And of course, the great thing that the data is not there, because the last thing the world needs are more terrorist attacks, right?
That's right. There's something funny about working in this area because, unfortunately, getting more data means that bad things are happening worldwide. But I think that the perspective that I bring to this question is essentially one of a natural scientist, which is to say that there's some process that's happening worldwide that effectively produces these terrorist events. And as tragic as each individual event was, nevertheless, we can study this as a general phenomenon and ask questions about what are the processes that produce these events worldwide? What are the possible things we might change in order to control those processes? And then, of course, in this case, the study, can we make forecasts based on our understanding of those processes about what the future might hold?
Fascinating study, Aaron. Aaron Clauzet, Assistant Professor of Computer Science at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and of course in the BioFrontiers Institute, and external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Aaron, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave.